Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, a little tour of San Gregorio Magno, the church where the Pope and the Archbishop of Canterbury are scheduled to meet this coming weekend. Spotlight on the London Olympic Games with Monsignor John Armitage, and a hymn written for choirs of angels to sing in heaven. But first of all, we go to St. Peter's Square, where Pope Benedict XVI held his weekly general audience. Chris Altieri reports.
Pope Benedict XVI held his weekly general audience on Wednesday, during which he concluded his series of catecheses on Jesus' own prayer. The particular focus of Pope Benedict's remarks was the importance of silence in our relationship with God.
In Christ's own life and prayer, and especially in his experience of the cross, we see a constant interplay of word and silence. Jesus' mortal silence on the cross is his final word to the Father, his supreme prayer. To hear God's word requires a cultivation of outward and inward silence, so that his voice can resound within our hearts and shape our lives.
Pope Benedict went on to say that Jesus teaches us that God also speaks to us, especially at times of difficulty, through his silence, which invites us to deeper faith and trust in his promises.
Jesus is our great teacher of prayer. From his prayer we learn to speak with confidence to our Heavenly Father as his beloved sons and daughters.
In this filial dialogue, said Pope Benedict, we are also taught to recognize God's many gifts and to obey his will, which gives meaning and direction to our lives. Also, during the course of the audience, the Holy Father had special greetings for the Patriarch of Cilicia of the Armenian Catholics, His Beatitude Nerses Bedros XIX Tarmuni, and for all the Armenian Catholic bishops come to Rome from various continents for their particular church's synod assembly. Pope Benedict expressed heartfelt gratitude to the bishops for their loyalty to the heritage of their venerable Christian tradition and to the successor of Peter. Offering his apostolic blessing, he promised earnest prayers for the work of the Synod Fathers in the hope that they will encourage greater communion and understanding among pastors and give renewed impetus to Armenian Catholics on the path of a generous and joyful witness to Christ and the Church. Pope Benedict concluded his greetings with thoughts and prayers for the regions of the Middle East, encouraging pastors and faithful there to persevere with hope amid the great suffering that afflicts them.
Estendo il mio orante pensiero alle regioni del Medio Oriente.
Following the audience, Pope Benedict received the German finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, in a private parlor within the Paul VI Hall. I'm Chris Altieri.
Now, I'd like to take you on a tour of a place Pope Benedict XVI is scheduled to visit this weekend. On Saturday, the 10th of March, in fact, he's going to visit the monastery of San Gregorio al Celio to take part in Vespers, together with the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. The event is timed to coincide with celebrations to mark 1,000 years since the founding of the Camaldolese, who live in the monastery here on the Caelian Hill, where, since the Second Vatican Council, this monastery has developed strong ties with Canterbury and the Anglican Communion. Ties that began centuries earlier with Gregory the Great, who at the end of the 6th century dispatched from here St. Augustine on his mission to convert England. Attached to the monastery and rising on top of an elegant flight of steps, there now stands the Roman Church of San Gregorio Magno, dedicated to Gregory the Great by a later Pope, Gregory II. Today, with the exception of the cosmatesque pavement and some ancient columns, the church is an example of Baroque splendour. But why don't you join me in this church as I visit with our Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis.
This is where St. Gregory once lived. There's his cell, and what's left at the moment is a marble throne where he used to sit. Mm. Very uncomfortable looking. In white marble.
It reminds me a little bit of the one, the Attila, the seat of Attila up on the island of Torcello. which he was supposed to have sat on, Attila the Hun, which would be. This is a smaller seat, so Gregory the Great must have been quite a small man. This church itself was built on the site of a monastery where Gregory the Great lived, and it was built by Pope Gregory II, this actual church. So elements of, let's say, of the older part of the church, the old church, are still here, like in the area there over to the right of the main altar. You have a little chapel, and in that chapel there's a 15th century altar with little bas-reliefs showing St. Gregory saying Mass. To the right of it you have a little room with sort of ornate kind of Renaissance style gold and pale grey decoration, little room where he used to sleep. This is according to tradition. And then nearby there are three little sanctuaries which don't form part of this church anymore. They're controlled by the Basilica of Santa Maria Maggiore, St. Mary Majors. But the influence of Gregory is over there as well, because one of the chapels is dedicated to him. The other chapel is dedicated to his mother, Sylvia, and the other chapel is dedicated to St. Andrew, because in effect the name of this church is really St. Andrew, St. Gregory the Great on the Caelian Hill. And going back to the tradition that Gregory the Great had of serving the poor, he used to serve every day to 12 people food, and the table still remains in one of the sanctuaries. And again, if you think about this tradition of feeding the poor and helping the needy, we just realise and think that the Little Sisters of Mother Teresa have a place just around at the back of this convent, so they've taken over a good section of it where they also minister to the poor. So to think that from the time of Gregory the Great, going back to the early centuries and to our century now, where you have Mother Teresa's nuns helping the poor, there's a great continuation of charity on the hill of the Celio. It makes you think also about the tradition of St. Giovanni and Paolo nearby, a place of Christian worship going back way, way back, about 2,000 years. So this area here tends to focus and keep to its chest, let's say, you know, really dear to its heart, these traditions of clear and simple Christian worship with martyrdom and the emphasis on martyrs. And then here in this particular Church of San Gregorio Magno, St. Gregory the Great, the tradition of charity and helping the poor and serving them by giving them food.
St. Gregory was also the Pope who sent St. Augustine to England.
Yes, he did. St. Augustine being sent to England to convert England to Christianity. So from this point of view, this particular church has an importance for England. And one of the emissaries sent by Henry VIII here to ask for permission from the Pope for Henry VIII's successive marriage, he remained here and he's buried in the little cortile, and the courtyard in front of the church. In front of the actual church, they built a type of atrium, and it's like a little courtyard, a smaller version of the one that you have in St. Paul's outside the walls. More intimate, and again, it has a lot of little tombs around. And the façade, which is quite imposing, because when you go around Rome, you tend to see it from a distance, was done by Soglia, who was the same man who did Santa Maria della Vittoria, where you have St. Teresa in Ecstasy by Bernini. It's his best work, a big, imposing church that just stands out in the middle of the trees and the greenery.
And these white steps going up.
Yeah. In fact, they're large and
very sort of grand, stately steps.
Yeah, because I think he tried to give it a sense of importance, because if you look across from the entrance of the church to the other side, you see all the buildings relating to early pagan Rome.
Palatine Hill.
And the Palatine.
And warm thanks there go to Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, for showing us round the Church of San Gregorio Magno, and in particular for discovering something about Gregory the Great's throne. Time to leave Rome and go over to London, as the Olympic rings are visible on the River Thames. A sure sign the London Games are but a few months away. In a few moments I'll be speaking to someone who definitely has those symbolic rings in mind. He's Monsignor John Armitage, who's both chair of the Catholic 2012 committee as well as Catholic trustee on the board of the Olympic charity More Than Gold, a title which is a clear reference to sports being more than just winning a gold medal. He sat down with me in our studios here, and before delving specifically into the forthcoming Summer Games in London, he highlighted how the church has always expressed an interest in sport and been present at previous games as well. In this interview, he begins, however, by pointing to how this time round Christian churches are working together in a special way. Just listen.
The Olympic organisers very clearly said that they can't work with each individual denomination or church group. So they asked right at the beginning that there should be a group that works together. So we had this coalition, which has been very effective, based on a charity called More Than Gold, which is a sort of coalition of Christian churches and groups. And that's got a number of programmes that we're all working on, involved in social justice, in hospitality, in mission teams, and a whole range of different things, special events where we can work together. We have another big one, big screen events. We're encouraging churches to get a screen and screen an event and run a sort of a social event around it. Also about how to engage young people and also to engage people in volunteering. There's official volunteering for the Games, but also to volunteer to run sports activities in parishes and schools. And also, we've got a thing called Games Pastors, which is there, which we've been asked to provide Games Pastors as greeters at Heathrow Airport and Gatwick and at the major London rail terminals as well. So as people are coming into London, they'll be greeted. Now, all that's been done under More Than Gold. In addition, Catholic community have really from day one been engaged. And I think it's probably fair to say that the involvement of the Catholic community has been very significant in this. And I think experience in the past has been that the Catholic Church hasn't been there necessarily from day one. Well, with the London Olympics, we have. So we've been able to develop three strands. The first is what we are doing ecumenically. The second is what is being done under the auspices of the Catholic 2012 Committee, which I chair. And there we're looking at a number of particular programmes. The first thing is the provision of chaplaincy for the athletes and the officials. Now, this is where we've been asked to provide chaplaincy on a 24-hour basis, which is quite an ask. So we have about 20 priests who are accredited now. There may be some more, but that's where we are, and religious sisters as well, who will have access to the Olympic Village. Now, that will be the most secure area of the whole site. But we will have access there. We'll be having daily Mass. We have our own chapel there. And we'll be having Mass, probably two or three Masses a day in different languages. So there will be chaplaincy support right the way throughout the whole of the Games and the Paralympic Games. So that's a very significant part of our contribution. And that is expected by the Olympic movement, that there will be support for people's religious beliefs. That is an interfaith expectation, so there'll be different ministers of different religions working there as well. So chaplaincy is a very big part of what we'll provide. Secondly, we will be looking to run hospitality ourselves, and that is that we'll be having two centres, one at Stratford, St Francis Church in Stratford, where we will be looking to have a place of welcome for any visitors who are coming along, and places where groups can come together and we can have some receptions. And also we're going to have some talks on the history of the Olympics and various events, and particularly to try and make more well known the teaching of Pope John Paul II on sport and faith. Being a great sportsman, he had much to say on sport and faith. And so we want to try and give a platform during the Olympics for some of the Holy Father's reflections on sport.
Given Monsignor Armitage has just spoken of Blessed John Paul II, I thought I'd interrupt our interview for a moment to bring you this Polish former sportsman's reflections. It's a recording from our Vatican Radio archives, which dates back, as you can guess from the sound of the Pope's voice, to the early years of his pontificate. As you'll hear in a moment, he speaks of the power of sports to unite and bring people together.
Competition between athletes is a universal language which immediately goes beyond the frontiers of nation, race, and political persuasion. All of this on condition that the men and women who engage in sport, especially on the international level, foster its inherent positive values without allowing it to degenerate through excessive concern for merely material advantages or through undue subordination to partisan ideologies.
And now we've listened to Blessed John Paul II's strong words there. We might say that he enters into the long-term legacy of the Olympic Games for the Catholic community, no?
From day one, within the Catholic community, we realised that we would invest a lot in an event, which was really good, but the event would be over
pretty quickly.
Yeah. So the question from Dane was, what did we want? What does a Catholic community did we want as a legacy for the Olympic Games? So we developed, certainly from the early days, a sense that we wanted to develop a proper legacy for the Catholic community. And that led to the establishment of the John Paul Foundation for Sport. We were very privileged when the Holy Father came to England 2 years ago.
Yes, that was at St Mary's Twickenham when he met with a group of young people from different schools and sports colleges across England. Of course, in England there's a strong tradition of sports.
Very strong tradition.
Within our schools. Tradition, yeah.
That's right, a very strong tradition. Foundation is there to, in some way, to continue to encourage people to reflect on John Paul's teaching, but also to help us to develop what was actually very strong in our parishes and isn't so strong now. It's very strong in our Catholic schools, that is our sports. But many parishes used to have sports clubs, boxing clubs and football clubs and rugby clubs and a whole range of different sports clubs. That's not quite so strong as it used to be. And one of the things we're hoping that the foundation will do is to encourage a new generation of sports coaches who will set up sports clubs and facilities within our parishes, and that we want to use our schools and our Catholic colleges as a way to be able to train this new generation of people. So it's trying to see sport in the best and the broadest sense of the word. Much of sport has had a very bad time because of different sorts of corruptions and scandals, and that has really undermined much. And the amount of money involved in sport very often undermines the spirit of the game. Now, we're trying through the John Paul Foundation to really understand, well, what is the spirit of a game? We talk about the spirit of a team. What does that actually mean? And so within the foundation, we're looking to see what that actually means and how we can find a language that will speak to the young people and the sportsmen and women of our current generation. And we feel that that would be a real legacy for the church and for our young people. And in a broader sense, you know, the people of our country as well, because sport in England and Wales is enormous. It is absolutely massive. But there are many concerns about some of the trends, particularly, about vast amounts of money that people earn. And very often certain sportsmen seem to be very distant from the people. And sport, in some ways, has just become a very large moneymaker, which in some ways undermines the whole spirit of the game. That before there is money, there is a game, and there is a game that has a spirit to it. How does one understand that? You know, there's much criticism very often about parents putting pressure on their children, you know, in terms of sport and winning. Well, certainly there is a very strong British tradition that the most important thing is that you play the game. It's playing the game that matters. If you win, it's good to win, but much more important that you play the game well, you play the game, and that's our great tradition. It's embodied in our national game of cricket, and it's something that isn't as strong as it used to be. And one would hope that some of the legacy from the Olympics, and particularly given an inspiration by Pope John Paul II, would be that we'll learn to play the game better.
And keep young people off the streets as well.
Keep young people
out of trouble.
Off the streets, indeed. Yeah. Sport is got to be one of the principal ways of engaging young people in a positive way. It's what they like to do.
Do you still do sports yourself?
I used to sail regularly on the tall ships. And that was until relatively recently. But my arthritis won't allow me to climb up the mast anymore, sadly.
So, no more sports for you and for people like yourself. But there's a whole world that revolves around the Olympic Games.
We're having a thing called the Joshua Camp. And the Joshua Camp will be for young people who want to come and be in London for the Olympics. Obviously, it's going to be very expensive. So what we're providing is basic accommodation, bed and breakfast accommodation. But also, in the mornings, there will be Mass and there will be some form of catechesis before they go out and either just walk around London or are involved in some way on a voluntary basis with some of the many programmes that have been run by different churches in London. And we hope to have in excess of 500 young people. Already they're booking to come in. And another aspect of it is the Church, St Francis Church in London, which is one of the oldest Catholic churches in London. In fact, it's where Alfred Hitchcock was baptised. St Francis Church will be having an exposition of the Blessed Sacrament 24 hours a day throughout the whole of the Olympic Games. And that's a very important part as well, because we want a place where people can come and pray, but where there are also people praying.
Getting back to the sportsmen, the athletes, do you think they need that kind of spiritual support?
Well, I think if you look at the average sports person coming to the Olympic Games, they've invested over 4 years of their life to get to a situation where they've been selected for their national teams and then coming to the Olympics. The fact of the matter is that, you know, 96, 97% of them are going to lose. Now, most of them know that, and just being in the Games in itself is a great honour. But for many people, they've invested so much, and there is a great emotional energy that goes into, as well as all the physical stuff. And for many people, you know, losing will be a real blow. And so being with people in what is a highly charged emotional environment is a very important aspect of chaplaincy. And to be able to put things in context and to be able to give them spiritual support is obviously a very important part. And to put things into perspective, I think, as well. I think one of the jobs of being a priest is sometimes is when people are in the midst of joy or tragedy or trial, one tries to give a bit of perspective and a broader vision. And I think that's one of the important things that our chaplains will do during this.
Your chaplains have pastoral experience, presumably, because yes. That's the kind of, you mentioned that right now, that's the kind of thing that you need when
yes,
you have
indeed,
to provide.
Yeah. They're all parish priests or chaplains. The chaplain to University of Oxford is one of our chaplains. And various people will be coming, but they're all very experienced in terms of the provision of pastoral care in their own particular walks of life.
And you were listening there to Monsignor John Armitage, who's both chair of the Catholic 2012 committee as well as Catholic trustee on the board of the Olympic charity More Than Gold. Our thanks go to him for sharing with us this information. Finally, let's end the broadcast on a musical note with Monsignor Philip Whitmore as he brings us a hymn written not for a congregation to sing in church, but for choirs of angels to sing in heaven.
I once knew a piano teacher who said she hoped there would be no music in heaven. She must have spent far too long listening to fistfuls of wrong notes from unwilling pupils. But I must say, I rather hope there will be music in heaven. I say that because I like a lot of the music we have down here, and just think how much more wonderful the music in heaven must be, sung by all those choirs of angels. Believe it or not, the words of the hymn we just heard were written not for a congregation to sing in church, but for choirs of angels to sing in heaven. They were written by John Henry Newman, the great English cardinal, as part of his dramatic poem, The Dream of Gerontius. It's a poem that's best known these days in the version set to music by another English Catholic, Sir Edward Elgar. It's about an old man, Gerontius, who dies and goes to heaven. There he meets his guardian angel, who leads him into the presence of God. As they approach, they hear the angelic choirs singing in the distance. Elgar obviously believed there would be music in heaven, and thankfully he composed this glorious oratorio to give us his idea of how it might sound. As Gerontius and his guardian angel come closer and closer to God's throne, the music builds up towards a tremendous climax. Praise to the holiest in the height, and in the depth be praise. Sing hymns of praise like that forever and ever. Down here, we do our best, but Elgar's music is a bit beyond most of us. Fortunately, other composers have set those same words to music, so we too can sing the Song of the Angels while we're gathered in church. Actually, there are quite a few different tunes to choose from, but the one I've chosen for today's programme is my favourite. Before I came to work in Rome, I used to work at Westminster Cathedral in London. It's a place that's always prided itself on its fine musical tradition ever since it was opened in 1903. The first master of music, Sir Richard Terry, brought to light much long-lost music by great composers of the past, and he also wrote music himself, including some very good hymn tunes. Hymn tunes always have names, and the tune he wrote for Newman's Praise to the Holiest is called Billing. That's the name of a place on the edge of Northampton. Let's listen now to Sir Richard Terry's setting of Cardinal Newman's great hymn of praise. And next time you sing this in church, remember, what you're singing is really the song of the angels in heaven.
And heartfelt thanks there to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.